From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, what does evolution want?
Evolution by natural selection, a process which has no purpose at all, nevertheless generates systematically things that do have purposes. We make our own purposes. We don't inherit our purposes from our ancestors or from God.
Many intellectuals, many scientists, many biologists are convinced that evolution has destroyed the notion of purpose. So one of the things that I try to do in my theology is to point out that that's not necessarily true at all.
So can you reconcile the apparently meaningless, random process of evolution with some underlying purpose, perhaps even belief in God? Today we'll examine that question and look back at Charles Darwin's own views on moral progress. Also, the startling discovery that human evolution is actually speeding up.
Today, what it takes to live is different than what it took for hunter-gatherers in the Pleistocene, and so it might be better for you to sort of shift.
If there is one strand of evolutionary theory that sticks in the craw of nearly every religious believer, it's the idea that human beings are just an evolutionary accident. But what if it's no accident we turned out the way we did? What if the evolution of humans, or some brainy creature like us, was inevitable once life first appeared on Earth? That's the radical idea of the highly regarded paleontologist and evolutionary biologist Simon Conway Morris. Steve Paulson went to visit Conway Morris in his office at Cambridge University in England and came back with this report.
What I do is I work on a very old-fashioned system. I have to use computers, but in fact I use just simple file cards. So, and I have a thousand of these cards here. If I want to discover what's going on with regard to poison frogs, here we go. This is good. There's a whole set of papers.
Simon Conway Morris looks happiest when he's rummaging through the marvelous intricacies of his favorite plants and animals, the canines of saber-toothed cats, the eye of an octopus, the way flowers make pollen.
And then we go down to such examples as the bees and their intelligence. That's quite interesting.
We're sitting in a cramped office in the Earth Sciences building in downtown Cambridge. Conway Morris has piles of books and papers scattered all over his room and file drawers stacked right on top of his desk, filled with thousands of case studies. He spent years marshaling evidence for what's called evolutionary convergence, when entirely separate evolutionary histories lead to the same kind of thing. For instance, the sharp teeth and slashing claws of different cats, or the capacity to grow crops in species as diverse as humans and ants.
But right at the back of the cephalopods, we have a little section called ink. What on earth is all that about? Well, many people are familiar that animals like squid and so forth can blow clouds of ink. But the really fascinating thing is it turns out that ink is much more than simply a cloud of opaque material to baffle people. There are chemicals in the ink which confuse the would-be predator. And in the sea hare, what they actually do is they persuade the spiny lobster, which wants to eat the sea hare, it persuades the light spiny lobster it is eating a meal. It's ridiculous.
Simon Conway Morris is a bit like those great 19th century naturalists who possessed an encyclopedic knowledge of Earth's creatures. Conway Morris first came into public view in Stephen Jay Gould's 1989 book, Wonderful Life. He was one of Gould's heroes, the young paleontologist who sifted through the Burgess Shale fossils to help uncover the remarkable story of the Cambrian explosion. Gould went on to argue that evolution is full of strange twists and turns, and he said if you reran the tape of evolution, an entirely different set of creatures would emerge, certainly not human beings again. But later, when Conway Morris wrote his own book about the Burgess Shale, he came to the opposite conclusion and argued that evolution is highly constrained. It can only move in certain directions. That's why he's so set on finding every possible example of evolutionary convergence, to show that plants and animals with completely different histories can end up with nearly the same characteristics.
Now, actually, one of the most interesting examples of an evolutionary convergence, that is to say, different starting points, as I would regard it, ending up with the same functional solution, is the camarae, which has evolved in us, that's vertebrates, which relative to the fish and so forth, and the jellyfish, yes. They too possess these eyes, which are, for all intents and purposes, constructed in exactly the same way as our eyes are. They're much, much smaller, of course, and of course it begs all sorts of interesting questions, because the jellyfish doesn't have a brain, for example, it has a nervous system. What I find very interesting is, in the Camarae, it's evolved in ourselves, it's evolved in a jellyfish, it's also evolved in such animals as a squid and the octopus, but it's evolved about another four or five times. And the really interesting thing about the Camarae is the animals it's evolved in typically tend to move fast, they tend to be predators, they tend often to be intelligent.
This question of intelligence is where Conway Morris's argument gets especially interesting. He claims it's inevitable that some simple organisms will evolve, eventually, many eons later, into intelligent creatures.
I'm interested in the emergence of biological properties. And so, for instance, if we have a cognitive landscape which we know is shared by other animals, then that seems to be a property of Homo sapiens, but it's not unique to Homo sapiens. And so you've really got to ask, how likely is it that certain cognitive landscapes will evolve? Well, I think it's actually rather likely.
I just want to follow up on this. Are you saying that there's something within the evolutionary process that leads inevitably to a highly intelligent species like Homo sapiens?
Well, I don't have any quarrel with the evolution of a highly intelligent species. I think that is an evolutionary inevitability, and I think any Darwinian biologist would have no quarrel with that, because we see so many examples of convergence, even in the octopus. The more we learn about the octopus in particular, things like their capacity for gaze, as we say, when interesting things happen, they definitely spend more time looking at them, their ability to play, their ability in certain cases to move from one tank to the other to get food they can see next door, all those sorts of things. And again, I'm not trying to say any more that the crow, the parrot, the dolphin, the chimpanzee, or the octopus are us. That's not my intention. What I'm saying is that they have cognitive capacities which are very much on the road to what is necessary to become fully human.
This is the most controversial part of Simon Conway Morris's argument, where he runs into trouble with the vast majority of evolutionary biologists. He sees the intelligence and even tool-making abilities of various animals, for instance, the way New Caledonian crows create rudimentary tools, as evidence that a highly intelligent species will inevitably emerge.
Don't worry about whether you're talking about a mammal or a bird. Think about the biological property, technology. Is that inevitability? Yes, the details of the evolutionary story would not be the same, but the end product, a sentient species with an advanced civilization, in my view, is an inevitability.
So, what do other experts on evolution think about this biological drive toward a highly intelligent species? I checked in with some prominent biologists. Ken Miller is a cell biologist at Brown University. Like Conway Morris, he thinks the evolutionary process will eventually produce a highly intelligent species.
And I think it's fair to say that given time and circumstance and resources, living organisms are not only going to find the earthworm-style niche, and they're not only going to find the pine tree-style niche, they're going to find the high intelligence niche as well. And I think that's why Conway Morris makes the argument that if not the evolution of humans in the sense of intelligent primates, but the evolution of an intelligent, reflective, self-aware being very much like us was, in his view, inevitable.
I don't think any such trend exists. Species evolve and they're just keeping up with a changing Earth.
That's Sean Carroll, a leading evolutionary biologist at the University of Wisconsin. He's written several books on evolution and writes a science column for the New York Times.
Animals exploit what's available. You know, dinosaurs were pretty spectacular. All we've got left from them are birds, right?
There is another school of thought here that if you play out the evolutionary process long enough, if you have a nice planet like Earth with good environmental conditions, you will inevitably get a highly intelligent species such as human beings.
Yeah, I'm not in favor of that idea. You know, again, this is where we've stepped into the picture and then, you know, think that the world was evolved for us. It's pretty clear that a few other rolls of the dice, it might not have come out this way. A lot of our ancestors went extinct. Why we made it, you know, is a whole complex interplay of factors. And clearly our intelligence and our cultural evolution has played a huge part in our at least momentary success. But was that inevitable? My personal view is no, that was not inevitable. That I'm too humbled by the accidents of nature and the flux that's there in the process, particularly in the environment, the geological and climatic environment of the Earth is incredibly dynamic. You know, the continents are moving, the oceans, sea levels are rising and falling, you have glaciations, you have ice ages. When we look at past extinctions of species, we understand that usually there's a pretty clear climatic reason for either a gradual or more rapid die out. I guess I would just say, hey, we could be a blip.
The noted philosopher of science Daniel Dennett agrees with Sean Carroll. Dennett's the author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Evolution and the Meanings of Life. He doesn't think much of Conway Morris's theory.
I think he's just wrong to say that this is inevitable. That's romantic and mistaken. Is the evolution of marsupials inevitable? I don't think that the inevitability of humanoid intelligence is any more inevitable than the inevitability of marsupials.
When you think about it, there are profound religious implications to this whole question of human inevitability. Many people of faith simply don't want to consider the possibility that we're an evolutionary fluke, just a lucky winner in the genetic sweepstakes. And it's worth pointing out that Conway Morris is a committed Christian, while Dennett is a highly visible atheist. So maybe it's no accident that Dennett scoffs at the idea that we humans had a date with destiny.
The idea that this whole great universe was in some sense designed or intended for us to show up strikes me as just bizarrely self-involved. One of the most stunningly narcissistic visions that I've ever encountered. Seems unlikely, don't you think?
But not all atheists agree with Daniel Dennett. Take the world's most famous atheist, the renowned British biologist Richard Dawkins. He thinks the evolutionary process does push toward intelligent life.
As a matter of fact, Simon Conway Morris and I are remarkably close. I mean, he's one of very few biologists who agrees with me, and I'm one of very few biologists who agrees with him on that very question. It's just that he thinks it implies some kind of theistic push, and I don't.
Ken Miller, the cell biologist at Brown University, is, like Simon Conway Morris, openly religious. Miller's a Catholic. In fact, he wrote a book called Finding Darwin's God, which recounts his own search for common ground between evolution and religious faith. But he says you don't have to make a religious argument for the evolutionary drive toward intelligence. He points to the late cosmologist Carl Sagan, one of the prime movers of the SETI project, and an outspoken atheist.
I just want to read you something. It's very brief, that Sagan wrote. He said, when we're talking about extraterrestrial intelligence, we're not talking about humans or humanoids. We are talking about the functional equivalent of humans. Say, any creatures able to build and operate radio telescopes. These creatures may live on the land or in the sea or air. They may have unimaginable chemistries, shapes, sizes, colors, appendages, and opinions. We are not requiring that they follow the particular route that led to the evolution of humans. There may be many different evolutionary pathways, each unlikely, but the sum of the number of pathways to intelligence may nonetheless be quite substantial. In other words, Sagan's arguing that you're going to get to that niche of intelligence one way or another.
Back at Cambridge University, Simon Conway Morris mulls over the question of how he reconciles his own Christian faith with his decades of work as an evolutionary biologist. He says purpose is a philosophical and religious idea, not a scientific one, so he never claims that evolution has some ultimate purpose, but it's clear that his religious beliefs have shaped his underlying view of reality.
If one starts with the assumption that the universe is very cannily constructed, but also is capable of indefinite investigation, is not simply a closed book whereby some Darwinians, I think, would say, well, that's it, we sorted everything out. And I'd say, what? Why would we want to think that?
If you're a Christian, if you were serious about wanting to reconcile science and religion, and you study evolution, do you have to assume that it was necessary for humans to evolve? Because it would seem to me that every Christian pretty much assumes that there have to be human beings, otherwise there wouldn't be religion, there would be no purpose to it. So could you be a good Christian and think, oh, well, you know, maybe human beings did not have to evolve?
First of all, the universe on a theistic viewpoint and a Christian viewpoint is utterly contingent. It needn't exist at all, but more particularly, it could be anything which God so chose. Science is an open-end adventure. We don't know where it's going to end. People who think that religion is simply a set of answers to keep you comfortable are, I am afraid to say, sadly mistaken. It is an open-ended adventure. We don't know really what the nature of the universe is. We don't know why we have our moral and ethical and intellectual and poetic capacities. I know they come from an evolutionary basis. I have no quarrel with that. But so far as I'm concerned, I think we're going on to completely new territory. And my view would be that, in fact, the religious instincts, the religious teachings, actually tell us something real about the world. They're not simply fairy stories.
That's paleontologist Simon Conway Morris speaking with Steve Paulson in his office in the Earth Sciences Building at Cambridge University in England. Coming up, Charles Darwin's life set to poetry. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, What Does Evolution Want? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, Five Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, by Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science, and by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
Did Charles Darwin himself think evolution marched inevitably toward greater complexity and, ultimately, to human beings? Historian and philosopher of science Robert Richards says yes. As he told Steve Paulson, this is a highly unorthodox view among Darwin scholars.
Darwin came to the view that progress, the development of more complex creatures, would be the inevitable outcome. And it was progress not simply in, as it were, biological complexity, the complexity of physiology and anatomy, but he also foresaw, at least the early Darwin did, a moral progress, that the universe was oriented toward the production of human beings. That's at least clear from his early notebooks.
Well, I have to say that this is not at all the conventional view among Darwinian scholars. I mean, most people I've talked to say that Darwin was the one who killed all sense of teleology and moral purpose.
Right.
I mean, sort of the great revolutionary idea of Darwin was that he divorced evolution from any sense of meaning or purpose.
I think that's the usual interpretation. You're absolutely right. But from my perspective, what has happened is there has been a rereading or a reading of contemporary neo-Darwinism back into Darwin's accomplishment. And needless to say, Darwin was not a neo-Darwinian. I certainly accept the orthodox view of evolutionary biologists today. But I don't think that was exactly Darwin's view.
It sounds like you're saying that this is all very interesting historically, but Darwin got it wrong, given what we now know about how evolution works.
Well, there's a certain sense in which any scientist that worked 2 years ago got it wrong, that his science develops, it progresses. But it's built upon earlier accomplishments, and there is certainly no doubt that what Darwin accomplished in The Origin of Species formed the foundation for the development of modern biology. But I think one of the other aspects of reexamining what Darwin accomplished is to appreciate Darwin's moral theory. And from his perspective, human beings are intrinsically moral creatures. Now, there has been, I would say in the last, 50, 60 years, a presumption that natural selection has produced creatures that, namely us, that are selfish. That wasn't Darwin's view.
Now, in the larger debate about evolution and religion, it would seem there is a great deal at stake about this whole question of purpose. I mean, it's just hard for a lot of religious believers to stomach the idea that evolution is strictly a product of random genetic mutations, that there is no underlying purpose, and human beings are just an evolutionary accident. Would you say this is an important question in terms of how we think about evolution?
Well, I think it certainly is. I mean, to follow out Darwin's trajectory just a little bit, The Origin of Species, published in 1859, that's the first edition. It goes through six editions, and Darwin is always changing it and responding to his critics. But it's during this period that there's a certain sense in which Darwin became a neo-Darwinian, so that by the mid-1860s, he had lost belief in a personal God. The term that he thought that best suited him was that formulated by his friend Thomas Henry Huxley, namely agnosticism. He was an agnostic. But when pressed, is this all a matter of chance? He said, well, he found it very difficult to believe that it was all a matter of chance. But then he said, but it's all very complex, and let each person believe what he will. And I guess I don't think the scientific evidence is going to allow us to move one way or the other on that question.
University of Chicago historian of science Robert Richards, talking with Steve Paulson.
Darwin pondered variations, the reasons for mutation. He wasn't feeling good, but he had money and time. He published The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. A lot of people didn't want to be descended from apes.
Ruth Padell is not only an acclaimed British poet, she is a direct descendant of Charles Darwin, and she grew up hearing stories about her famous ancestor. Now Padell's written a book called Darwin, A Life in Poems. Here's an excerpt from a poem called On Not Thinking About Variation in Tortoiseshell, which takes us back to the time when Darwin puzzled over the strange creatures he saw in the Galapagos Islands.
Look, giant tortoises. Travelling eagerly, their necks outstretched to springs. I tried riding on their backs, but found it hard to balance. The colony's vice-governor told us he knew which island any shell came from, because they differ. I did not for some time pay this enough attention. I never dreamed that islands 60 miles apart, made of the same stone, of nearly equal height in the same climate, could have different tenants. Fast forward 20 years, and you see him write of this scatter burst of rock in open sea. We seem brought near that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on the earth.
This is a great moment in Darwin's life, although even in your telling, I'm not sure he knew it at the time.
It was a very interesting moment. He'd been there for nearly 5 years on that boat going around South America. I mean, when he first got into a hammock in Plymouth around Christmas time in 1831, he had the Greek Testament with him in Greek. He had Milton's Paradise Lost. He had Lyell's Geology. And he believed in the Bible story and Genesis, as everybody did. He was going to be a parson. And 5 years later, this is the Galapagos, it says September 1835, 4.5 years later, he had revised his opinions about a lot of these things, principally about the geology, because he realized that all these, the dead sea animals that he was seeing, that is the fossils, meant that the earth must be much, much older than any Bible story could convey. But it was when he was sailing away from the Galapagos, he sat down in his journal, he wrote a long, long note on the ornithology in which he really was challenging what a species was and whether new ones could come to be. And that was the radical idea. Everybody believed that species could not change.
Listening to you talk about it, I'm realizing, I think, why you decided to render his life in poems. You see it as full of life, as full of art as it is of science. But this is unusual, this decision to write a biography of Darwin in poems. And when did that idea come to you?
Well, I mean, a long time ago, I was a classics major in college, and then I did a PhD. And while I was doing that, I looked after my grandmother, who was his granddaughter, Nora Barlow. Her name was Nora Barlow. She was nearly 100. She'd lost her short-term memory, but my goodness, she could do the Times crossword, okay, faster than anybody. And she'd also had her long-term memory was fine. And she was the first person to work on Darwin's papers at all. She, in 1933, she edited the journal of the Voyage of the Beagle and his notebooks. She was really the first person to look at those notebooks and put them together and think about them. And in those amazing conversations, as I was sort of cooking her scrambled eggs and things, she told me that when Charles was evolving his ideas, it was very difficult for his wife, Emma, because she was a devout Christian and he knew it and they were very close and it was a very honest and transparent relationship. And she also said, do not ever change what you're thinking for fear of hurting me. Mm. But I thought, oh, I would love to write something about that.
His voyage on the Beagle, I gather, was really where it began. And you bring it to life in several of the poems. There's one of them I wonder if you'd read, in fact, The Cat O' Nine Tales.
Oh, my goodness, yes, sure. When he was in Cambridge, he wasn't a scientist. He was studying divinity. He was going to be a parson. It was the botany professor who suggested to him that he might go on this Admiralty expedition to map the coast of South America. But his father said, no, you can't go. These ships are dreadful places, terrible discipline, and you catch disease. But his father came round. Of course, as soon as the ship set sail, first of all, he was very seasick. And secondly, he realized his father was quite right, that there was this dreadful discipline. They were delayed over Christmas because the crew went ashore and all got drunk. And this is the first thing that he experienced on board. Cat O' Nine Tails. Shrieks above, on deck. That's one sailor lashed by the cat 25 times for drunkenness. Three strands of rope unraveled into three. A trinity of trinities set sinners on the path to righteousness. Drum rolls. All hands to witness punishment. In the Bay of Biscay, the naturalist lies retching on the floor, trying not to picture barbed knots biting across on every spine and shoulder blade. A glary scarlet scribble on open flesh. Again, again, again. 31 lashes for neglect of duty. Disobeying orders, 34. 44, that's drunkenness with insolence. The captain says he must establish order from the start.
You know, I wonder while you're there if you would read the very next one, Plankton, which is a different view of that same voyage. A little bit more of the joy he found in it, I think.
Absolutely. And this is really the first time he starts to be a proper naturalist. This is January 1832, and the Beagle is heading south through the North Atlantic towards the Cape Verde Islands. Plankton. The deck is dazzle, fish stink, gauze-covered buckets, gelatinous ingots, rainbows of wet flinching amethyst and flubbed iridescent cream. All this means he's better and working on a haul of lumpen light. Polyps, plankton, jellyfish, sea butterflies, the pteropods. So low in the scale of nature, so exquisite in their forms, you wonder at so much beauty, created apparently for such little purpose.
That's wonderful. Of course, one of the great mysteries is why Darwin waited several decades before he wrote The Origin of Species. Apparently he wanted to get the science right before he published his great book. But he was also worried about the reaction of his wife, Emma, who, as you said, was a devout Christian. You have a poem about salvation, which deals with her fears. Could you read this?
I'd love to. I'm very glad you picked that one out, because her mind, her voice, that was one of the joys for me of doing this work, was learning her voice and her thought. But it was very painful to her. This is when she's pregnant and they're living together, but she has one big last try to get him to see things as she does. She writes him a note about salvation. When I talk to you face to face, I cannot say exactly what I wish. Her back aches all the time. His friend's wife has died in childbirth. You say you are uncertain about Christian revelation, but your opinion is still not formed. He's told her his discoveries. She'd love him to be right in everything. She's very afraid he's not. Faith is beyond our comprehension, not provable in the scientific way you like. I believe you sincerely wish to learn the truth. But there are dangers in giving up revelation and Christ's offer of eternal life. My fear is for the afterlife. I cannot say how happy you make me in this one, nor how dearly I love you. I thank you for all the affection, which makes my happiness more and more each day. But everything that concerns you concerns me. I should be most unhappy if I thought we would not belong to each other for eternity.
unimaginable that she really thought they wouldn't.
Well, that was the most common thing. May I read the next little one too?
Oh, please.
Because this one is so important. That letter that I've used in that poem was found among his things after his death for her to find with his little note on it. He died in 1881 and that letter was written in 1839. So it was a tatty old letter which he'd written on the edge of. He leaves a message on the edge. He kept her note all his life. He must have said something then, but he wrote to her too on the outer fold. No one knows when. He was maybe quite old. He wasn't blind to where his thought led, what she thought she'd lose. When I am dead, no, I have kissed and cried over this many times.
Ruth Padell is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Her book is called Darwin, A Life in Poems.
Chromosome divide, multiply and thrive, and the strong survive, yeah, the strong survive. And the grandson of an alien wears his snakeskin boots, shows his reptile roots.
Later this hour, the strange questions paleoanthropologists ask themselves.
What are my favorite skulls? You go to something like OH5, a real classic recognizable skull. If you imagine the scene at the end of Close Encounters, where the aliens kind of come out of the spaceship, and you see they're sort of like us. You know, they're toddling around, and they're bipeds. They're on two legs, and they've got arms, and they're sort of funny looking. That's what these guys were like, these real early hominids. The difference between these and the aliens is that these guys were probably furry, and they had very small brains. But the world was full of them until 1.2, 1.3 million years ago, and they're gone.
As the Virginia Slims ad used to say, you've come a long way, baby. But human evolution isn't done yet. In fact, it's speeding up. For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, What Does Evolution Want? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, 5 Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series, Science and the Search for Meaning, 5 Questions, is supported by grants from the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions. By Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science. And by the Neuer Foundation, exploring meaning and commonality of human experience.
For all the yelling between creationists and scientists, there's one perspective that's largely absent from public discussions about evolution. The religious believers who accept the standard Darwinian account of evolution. It's a shame because there's an important question at stake. How can a person of faith justify that faith after Darwin? That's the question John Haught has set out to answer by proposing a theology of evolution. Haught's a Roman Catholic theologian at Georgetown University. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
For years, we've been bombarded by arguments over religion and evolution, and yet you say theology has not yet come to grips with Darwin. What are theologians missing?
The reason that there has been resistance, I mean, this has been probably one of the most dramatic events that theology, at least in the West, has ever had to face. The Darwinian story of evolution seems to give people a whole new creation story, different from the one that they had lived under for so many centuries.
You're talking about more than just the story of Genesis in the Bible. You're talking about a much bigger issue for most modern theology.
Yes, the story of Genesis has been hyped as the only problem. That's one of many aspects of the problem. I think the fundamental difficulty is the new evolutionary world in process, a world that's unfinished, a world that's still being created, the world that still, you might say, every day comes up a little further above nothingness, is so different from the cosmology that was the backbone or the backdrop of traditional spirituality and moral aspiration.
Now, I would have thought that the real challenge, the biggest challenge that evolutionary theory poses to most religions is the sense that there's no inherent meaning in the world. I mean, if you look at the process of natural selection, this apparently random series of genetic mutations, it would seem that there's no place for ultimate purpose there, that human beings are just an evolutionary accident.
In order to have a sense of meaning or purpose, there has to be some hierarchical structuring, you might say, of the cosmos. And when you come to the new scientific understanding of the universe, it seems that there are no sharp breaks between lifeless matter and life, between life and mind, and so that the traditional hierarchical structuring of meaning has become fluid. And it seems to many people that the new evolutionary picture of things places everything in the context of a meaningless smudge of stuff. Now, if you look at the new cosmography, it seems that mindless matter dominates the whole picture. You're right. Many intellectuals, many scientists, many biologists are convinced, as is Richard Dawkins, for example, and Stephen Jay Gould, that evolution has destroyed the notion of purpose. So one of the things that I try to do in my theology is to point out that that's not necessarily true at all.
Well, it would seem that there might be a simple response to this, that purpose is a matter for theologians and philosophers to argue about, but purpose is simply not a scientific word, that the two have nothing to do with each other. Do you accept that distinction?
I sure do, but I want to point out how that distinction is usually violated in scientific literature and in much discussion of evolution. I believe that science, from the beginning of the modern world, decided quite rightly that it wasn't going to tackle such questions as purpose, value, meaning, importance, or talk about God, or even talk about intelligence or subjectivity. It was going to look for purely natural, efficient, causal, mechanical explanations of things. But what happens is that that principle of scientific Puritanism is often violated by so-called experts who think that by dint of their scientific expertise, they are now able to comment on such things as purpose. And I consider that to be a great violation.
Give me examples of what you mean, of scientists who extrapolate about purpose from science.
Well, a good example is the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg, who in his book Dreams of a Final Theory says that once science gets down to what he calls the fundamental levels of reality, he asks, will we find God? And it's almost as though he assumes that science itself has the capacity, the prowess, the power, the right to comment on things like that. My view is that theology, instead of trying to ignore it or close its eyes to it or shove it in the drawer, should look it squarely in the face. And it has everything to gain and nothing to lose by doing so. And in my own work, what I try to do in my book, God After Darwin and Others, is to argue that in a sense, Darwin's thought is a gift to theology.
You're saying that it's forced theologians to sharpen their thinking?
Yes, and I came to this whole idea of evolutionary theology long, long ago when I was still a very, very young man. I read the works of a famous Jesuit paleontologist named Teilhard de Chardin. And Teilhard in the early 20th century was saying pretty much what I'm saying today. And Teilhard was sent by his superiors to study geology and paleontology, and he was a priest at the time, and he was trying to think, well, what does what I'm learning about the evolutionary character of life on Earth have to do with my Christianity? And he started writing essays synthesizing evolution into a very broad understanding of his faith. And his religious superiors thought that these essays that he was writing were just a bit too adventurous for the time, so they shipped him off to China, which is the wrong place to send people who like to dig up old bones, because Teilhard got involved in expeditions that uncovered Peking Man and other interesting evolutionary phenomena. And during all this time, 25 or so years in China, he was still trying to develop his ideas, synthesizing Christianity and Evolution. And he was writing his major work, The Phenomenon of Man, now translated as The Human Phenomenon, but he could not get it published in his own lifetime because the church and his superiors were not ready for this, it seemed. But after he died, his lay friends took his works and they flooded the religious world with these publications. And it ended up that Teilhard had an enormous influence on religious thought, especially Catholic thought.
Didn't he make the point that the universe is still evolving? That's sort of the transformation that he was trying to chart. And he saw that in the natural world as well.
Yeah. What he did, and this is what a lot of biologists do not do, is he put the Darwinian chapters of the story of nature in the larger context of cosmic evolution. And he saw that you can, by anybody's standards, see an emergence of what he called more coming in from the time of the Big Bang, let's say. Atoms become molecules, molecules become cells, cells become organisms, organisms become vertebrates with a complex nervous system, nervous tissue develops and eventually becomes very, very complex in humans. And it raises the question, well, where is this process of complexification, which is accelerating today at an enormous pace because of communication technology, engineering, economics, politics. The globe is shrinking. We're able to connect instantaneously with other aspects of the Earth. We should expect and we should look for and hope for the universe to keep becoming more.
Earlier, you said that cosmic purpose is a question that lies outside of science, but it sounds like you're bringing it into science here. There's this inexorable process towards more complexity, and if you want to look for purpose, whether it's evolution or whether it's within the larger universe, that's what it is.
Okay, we have to distinguish between science as a method and what science produces in the way of discovery. As a method, science does not ask the questions of purpose. And rightly so, it brackets those out. But when we look at the cumulative results of scientific thought as well as technology and so forth, then that's part of the world that we have to, from a theological point of view, integrate into our religious visions. And what is the purpose? The purpose seems to be, from the very beginning, the intensification of consciousness. And if you understand purpose as the actualizing of a value or the bringing about or realizing of something that's unquestionably good, then consciousness certainly fits. A universe which has been in the business from the very start of bringing forth a complexity which has a correlative intensity of consciousness is a pretty good universe.
John Haught is a Catholic theologian at Georgetown University. His books include God After Darwin and God and the New Atheism. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You'll find a transcript of Steve's entire interview with John Haught on our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. For decades, the prevailing view of human evolution has been that it's over. That if you stripped off your clothes, you and I would actually look quite a lot like our Stone Age ancestors. Better hairstyles and dental hygiene. But at the University of Wisconsin, paleoanthropologist John Hawks runs a lab that's been coming up with new evidence to the contrary.
This would be an example of what we'd call a robust skull. So a robust skull has got stuff sticking out of it. It's got a brow ridge. You've got this ridge on the back, and there's this bar of bone over it. Teeth are quite large. Actually, let me run just a second. I'll get another skull so I can show you what I'm talking about.
Ann Strainchamps recently stopped by John Hawks' big, echoey bone lab to look at some human skulls and talk about how humans are evolving. Some changes, he told her, are obvious.
When we look at the kinds of things that skeletally have shifted in the last 10,000 years, you're looking at things that some of them very noticeable. You know, the brain shrank. We got smaller heads in that last 10,000 years. You know, we're talking about, in Europe, the skull reduced in its volume by about 10%. So it's reduced by a lot. Why is it reduced? Well, this is sort of straightforward why it should reduce. The brain uses energy. It's about 20% of your minimum output in terms of energy use. That's a big cost. And if you could sort of cut that down a little bit, you'd have more energy for other stuff.
Or sort of like making a smaller, more efficient car.
Exactly right. It's exactly what it is.
We've evolved to be the hybrids.
It's exactly right. Now, think about how that could happen. It could happen just as it did in cars, by getting the same horsepower out of a smaller engine, or it could happen by tolerating less horsepower.
I can't quite figure out if you're saying our brains are more powerful just in smaller cases or whether our brains are in fact lesser than the brains of our ancestors.
We don't know is the answer. So if I ask my students, why did the brain get smaller? The first answer is idiocracy. You know, people are getting dumber. The second answer is, well, maybe they're getting more efficient. Right. You know, maybe it's changed because we're doing more with less tissue.
Now, one thing that's striking is that we're sitting here in front of a pile of bones in your bone lab, but we're talking about genetic variation and genetic evolution. It strikes me that the job of a paleoanthropologist must be really different today.
Well, it's absolutely changed. You know, genetics today, you can look at the human genome on the genome browser. Anybody can do this. It's totally free. And you can look at variations in the genome. And so if we're in my lab plotting out parts of the genome that look like they've been impacted by selection, we'd say, well, what do they do?
Are there specific changes you can point to, specific way stations along the way?
Well, I think that, you know, the big event is the first agriculturalists. You know, when we settled down, started living in villages, started eating all these cereals, you know, we're eating wheat, in the New World they're eating corn. This is all stuff that hunter-gatherers are not good at. And so the best examples are things like lactase persistence. It's normal for mammals to drink milk when they're babies, but not when they're grown-ups. And so they, over the course of maturation, lose this ability to digest lactose. Well, some humans have the ability to continue that, the production of the enzyme lactase that lets that happen. That's a mutation. It happened, we now know, at least 5 times in different ancient human populations, all of them in the last few thousand years.
And why is that?
Because of the advantage. This is a population that depended on dairy animals to a greater or lesser extent, but only after they domesticated cattle, goats, sheep. So it's that domestication that creates a new environment. You're drinking milk because it's available to you. If you could just digest that sugar a little better, then you get a bonus, more energy out of it. And so the environmental change creates the opportunity for a genetic change.
So a genetic variation occurs. Some infants are born with this new gene that lets them digest lactose. Those infants have a better chance of surviving. They pass the gene on, and pretty soon you have a a few generations later, you have a population that can digest milk easily.
Exactly right. So imagine a woman who's pregnant, and she has to maintain a high energy input to maintain a pregnancy or to maintain her own lactation. What difference would it make to get 30% more calories out of milk? It'd make a lot of difference.
Well, so far, in terms of the way humans are evolving, you've mentioned the ability to digest lactose. Mm-hmm. Any other major ways in which humans have evolved?
One of the kinds of genes that I'm real interested in my lab is genes that are related to the hair cells of the inner ears.
Why are you interested in that?
Well, so the inner ear is the part that hears things. And the hair cells don't make hairs. They have tiny, what are called stereocilia on top of them. And those stereocilia are what are essential to receiving sounds in your ears. And it turns out that about a dozen or 20 of these genes in different human populations have changed under selection in the last 10 to 20,000 years. That's more than you'd expect from
and
chance.
So why would that be?
Well, we can run hypotheses, right? Hypothesis. The reason why these genes are selected is because humans are adapting to language in some way. You know, they have to hear words better. We know that humans hear a different range of sound sensitivities than chimpanzees do. So we know that there's been change. Maybe we're becoming better at it. Maybe when you start living in cities, you have to be able to recognize different voices better. And so there's a social aspect to it. Maybe it has to do with the kinds of languages that you're speaking in different populations. And so maybe they're tone languages or not. So lots of hypotheses.
You know, I know anthropologists have a very different sense of time than, yeah. than the rest of us. But when you're talking about human evolution and the fact that it's speeding up, how fast might you actually see that playing out? You know, the proverbial grandparent who said, oh, kids today are not what they used to be. Are they right?
If we look at people that we dig out of the ground 5,000 years ago in Germany, not one of them that we've found so far has the gene that allows lactose digestion.
Just 5,000 years?
Just 5,000 years ago. If we look at people who lived in the Ukraine about 3,000 years ago, about 20% of them had it. Today, in Germany, 80% or higher. That means that 95% of people can digest this. They carry at least one copy of it.
So that's a change that happened in 3,000 years or
that's
less.
That's a change that happened in 3,000 years or less. If we measure people's teeth 3,000 years or less, there's been a big difference. I mean, it's that kind of thing where we can say that we are not the same people that the Romans were. We have different genes today. And that's what has been going on, by our estimates, for thousands of human genes.
We're also living through another period of enormous transition as we move, you know, out of the old industrial economy and civilization into the new world of multimedia. Is that likely to produce another big, fast pile of evolutionary changes?
The easy answer to that question, but the one that sort of ends the discussion, is, well, we're going to start genetically engineering people. And then, of course, things speed up because the potential for change is much higher. You know, now it's not just you wait for the random change to happen. You choose the change. And once that takes off, you can only imagine what will be possible.
John Hawks is a paleoanthropologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He talked with Ann Strangchance in his lab.
Did he crawl on up out of muck and mire? Well, a man on the street believes what the Bible tells him so. But you can ask me, mister, because I know. Tell them soul-sucking preachers to come on down and see. Pardon man, pardon monkey, baby, that's me.
For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, What Does Evolution Want? Is part of our special series, Science and the Search for Meaning, 5 Questions, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Original theme music for the series was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series, and to find additional material about the topics we've explored, please go to our website at ttbook.org/scienceandmeaning. And special thanks to two of our sponsors for Science and the Search for Meaning, the John Templeton Foundation, supporting science, investing in the big questions, and Promega Corporation, providing tools and technologies for research in life science.
PRI, Public Radio International.